you can find a lot of good engineers that are really smart that don't want to help other people. They just want to do their own thing. And so I think it's that good mix of the ones that want to be the teachers and the ones that on the other side want to learn from those people and just don't want to figure them out themselves.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Ryan Carroll. Ryan is the VP of Engineering at Xylo. Xylo is a SaaS company that helps you manage your SaaS spend. Last year, the team raised a $9 million Series A, and they're growing fast. Ryan has hired 20 engineers to date, and he plans to hire 10 more in the next year. Ryan's team is running some really interesting experiments in team structure and cadence and how to work with a product team. I think you'll enjoy this episode. And now, here's my conversation with Ryan Carroll. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes. Glad to be here.
What is the most important inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
I thought about this, and I think for me, it was probably that point when I was tapped to become a manager. In my career prior to this, I don't think I really had thought of myself as becoming a manager. And it was actually the day IGO Digital got acquired by ExactTarget, Eric Tobias came to me and asked me if I wanted to kind of take over the team at that point, as we kind of were figuring out new structures. We were going to start the merger. And really, it was just kind of an exciting time for him to kind of trust me to kind of officially take ownership over that team and to really start to build out what we were going to do as we started to scale up.
Yeah, that's an exciting conversation. So Eric went to another part, was kind of moving into the acquired org, and you were like moving up to own the team that he had been running.
Yeah, there was kind of two parts. There was kind of the product team, and then the customer services engineering team, and really was going to own that part and really kind of help kind of build out that structure as we were going to merge into ExactTarget.
And had you considered that to be the obvious next step in your career, leading teams, or were you thinking you'd go down the individual contributor track?
Probably at that point in my time, I'd really not thought about it. I mean, it really just was along for the ride at that point, and really the individual contributor, probably architect route, was kind of that natural flow that I was in. But then I was also kind of help organize the engineers that were doing the work with the customer success team, and so really kind of seemed like more of a natural fit to probably progress into that management role.
And how was that first couple years of changing roles?
Well, there wasn't just that. I mean, there was the acquisition and all of that change as well. I think it was tough to kind of, I think, draw the line between being a peer and a manager. I mean, I think that's still a pretty tough one when to turn that on and turn it off. I think I'm still kind of learning that today as well.
I struggle with the amount of measuring myself by what I build versus measuring myself for what my team builds. That was always a really early struggle for me. Were you able to manage that transition?
Yeah, I think I still am. I still try to open a pull request at least once or twice a month or something, but it is definitely a different lens. And as kind of having my first manager on the team today, something we kind of talk pretty often about is how to kind of judge your work, not in your output, but the success of the team.
So when you have your one-on-ones with that new manager, that's something you bring up is, you know, how do we judge success?
Yeah, because I think he's going through it the same way, like just kind of figure out how do you grade your day or your week or your month when you're not writing code. It's definitely kind of a mind shift for engineers.
You've been doing some thinking about Agile, you know, capital A Agile and lowercase a Agile in relation to Bates Basecamp's new book. Do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about that book and then kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, so I think what they do is they question a lot of things. So if you follow them on Twitter or social media, those two guys are pretty active in that world, sharing their opinion on software development. And I think what their main premise is that we've kind of overgrown the scope that we should tackle on a project, and they're really trying to figure out how do you most efficiently whittle down that project to successfully deliver it and keep iterating on it in a timely fashion. And something that I think most teams I've been on, we've adopted Agile. We've kind of done the opposite. We try to build the best thing. Scope continues to grow and grow. and you really can't deliver it in a timely fashion. It takes, and that's why I think estimating is really hard. It continues to grow to such a big idea that you really can't get your hands around it to know when you're actually going to deliver it.
So how much is this a book about product management versus how much is this about engineering and delivery?
It's probably 70% product management, because I think it's really changing how that team interacts with us, but then also how we work with that team and how we take some more ownership of the project and deliver it back to them versus having them really kind of almost hold our hands through the process where they're writing the stories, they're organizing the meetings, really having us kind of flip that and have us own a lot more of the delivery of the product.
That makes sense to me. So maybe Agile didn't go far enough. Like if product management is a separate discipline, maybe that's the way Agile can evolve. And is this book called Shape Up? Is that the right
yes.
book?
Yes, that's right.
And how much are they, how much is this an extension of Agile ideas versus throwing some of the ideas away?
I think it's throwing some of the ideas away. So one of their big ideas is to time box the amount of work, how much your time you're going to spend on the project, which is a pretty big shift from Agile. So in their book, they talk about kind of 6 weeks as being kind of that ideal timeline, because that can give you a big enough block of time to actually go build something, but a short enough window that you can pretty clearly kind of think through what you can go deliver successfully in 6 weeks. And I think those things really kind of, I think, break the Agile methodology a little bit, of that kind of continuing to build upon what you've built and really kind of setting a hard deadline for yourself to narrow down that scope to what you can be successful in those 6 weeks.
So time boxing to 6 weeks, and then this is a replacement for either, you know, 1 to 2 week sprints and also Kanban style continuous delivery?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think it's, you don't have to hold the work for the 6 weeks and then deliver it at the end, but really kind of leaving that up to the teams to decide how they best work within that 6 week window. Do they need stand-ups, or can they use software to do the stand-ups? Do they really need that backlog grooming every week? Because I think there's a lot of effort was put into place to get your demos ready for that week-to-week meeting. Can we really spend that time better and just continue to update each other verbally or writtenly and really just communicate outside of kind of showing the work that we've done?
Are you going to make any changes at Xylo as a result of this read? Or are you considering any changes?
We are. It's kind of morphed bigger than I had planned. So we thought we'd try it with one team. We've kind of got three teams doing it right now. We're trying so they're a big believer in it's much smaller teams. And so today we were running 4-person teams. We're trying a couple at 2. We're really trying to focus down what those 2 people can do, but also trying to provide them the focus so that they don't have other interruptions throughout those 6 weeks. That's a big part of it too, is saying you're not going to work support during those 6 weeks. You're not going to be interrupted. Really trying to let you focus in for that whole block of time and deliver what you said you would deliver.
So I think we had Will Larson, the VP of Infrastructure Engineering at Stripe, and his take is you need 6 to 8 engineers on a team to really cover on call. And then we had Melissa from the VP of Engineering at Drift, and she's more 3-person teams. So they have like a team of 3 inside a squad of 10, and there'll be 2 squads of 3 engineers, and then product design and customer support. It sounds like you're tilting more towards the 3-person teams there.
I think so. I think the 2 to 3. I think as we think associate engineers or new hires, as they start to onboard, I think they have to be on a team of 3. But I think there are small enough slices of the product where we could go just put 2 people on that, let them focus on that for 6 weeks and deliver it. We were running 4-person teams. We really had sometimes 2 to 3 to even 4 epics running at the same time across that team. And it was really, I think, distracting in the end, where we were wrapping up one project, opening another, there maybe one was mid-flight. And so really, I think a lot of context shifting behind the scenes that we really didn't acknowledge was happening.
How does your product management and design support fit in with these 2 and 3-person teams?
So right now we've got really 3 product owners today. So they're kind of aligned to, I would say, 2 to 3 teams. And right now we have one designer kind of covering the entire team, but an open head count. So hopefully kind of split. We've got design running out pretty far ahead of where we're building. So we've got a lot of pre-work kind of baked in. And so we can kind of pick and choose which projects we're going to work on.
And moving to these smaller teams, sounds like the goal is to reduce context switching. So you have fewer epics in flight. What other, what have been some of the surprising problems that have popped up that you had to figure out how to work around as you've shrunk those team sizes?
Really, the big one is the support and deployment. So today we had deployment restricted to a handful of individuals just for security of data, and really trying to figure out how we manage that with letting those individuals have that focus. Because when you have that deployer duty for the week, you are pretty busy deploying out what 20-some people are working on. And so really trying to figure out how we mix that in. And so I think what we'll end up doing is having one team, possibly two, kind of rotate through those support duties and smaller projects through those 6 weeks.
So I might, if I'm during one six-week cycle, I might have 1 week where I am on support duty and deploy duty. Is that the idea?
Yeah, or it'd probably be a couple weeks, but that idea. And then maybe you have a 2 week project that you'd try to mix in there that we know you could kind of fit in with those other responsibilities.
It's like bug squashing or something more interrupting.
Yep. Yeah.
That makes sense. And is that deploy restriction? How much is that just an intentional decision based on constraints right now? And how much is that a SOC 2 thing?
It's really a data privacy thing that is driven by customers. So the big thing that they're asking for is we're receiving all this financial data is to limit the percentage of employees that have access to that data. So really limiting the number of engineers that have production access. And we'd like to not have engineers deploying to production without all that access, because it could really limit what you could investigate if there was an issue. And so we've just tried to keep that pool pretty small compared to the relative size of the team.
Gotcha. So right now, the ability to deploy is tied to the ability to have full production access, which kind of makes sense. If something goes wrong, you probably need to be able to debug it.
Yes.
And the underlying restriction is you want to restrict data access. So maybe in the future, you could decouple those things if you added some level of maybe some abstraction where you could debug without full data access.
Yeah, or encrypt that data or abstract it so you wouldn't know whose data that is, or better tools to kind of prevent data loss. Definitely some stuff we could do as we grow. This was probably just the easier of the all those options.
That is often the right choice when it comes to infrastructure. So what can we get away with today? It's always a little bit broken.
Yes.
So this Basecamp book was 70% product management. You've shrunk your teams. It sounds like you already kind of were feeling that pull. How has that changed your interaction with your product owners as you've decided to scope things down to these 6 week cycles more and more?
Really good. We're only 2 weeks in, but
okay.
Last week was pretty enjoyable to have some time where we are starting. So what they also call pre-development work is called shaping. And so what we're starting to do is to shape the work that we're going to sign up to start in October. And so we're working right now. It's mainly myself and the other manager on the team are working to start to shape those projects. And then as we get further in the process, we'd bring in engineers to kind of further shape what they're going to commit to. But really changing that from a day-to-day interaction to more of a big picture, future-looking endeavor has been pretty exciting.
And do you use OKRs, any kind of planning cycle like that to tie to that six-week cycle?
We do. So we use OKRs. We were doing quarterly goals. But I think what we'll end up doing is these essentially become two-month goals. So the idea with the 6 weeks of focus is you've got 2 weeks to cool down in between those six-week cycles. So essentially new goal setting pretty much every 8 weeks will happen.
Gotcha. So it's not 2 6-week cycles within a quarter. It is just you're on a two-month cycle, so you're kind of not aligned with quarters anymore because of the two-week
yeah.
cooling off.
Which we're still trying to figure out exactly the best goal setting. So we're talking about making just second half of the year goals versus quarterly goals. But really, I think just trying to make it sure it works the best for us.
Yeah, it seems I follow John Cutler at Amplitude. He he has the a job where he gets to interview a lot of product teams, a lot of engineering teams about exactly how they work. And he posts a lot about how the best teams he finds, even if they're 90% by the book, Agile or by the book Kanban, they always change that last 10% and then call it their thing. Everyone's like, I think that act of making it yours kind of has teams bought in a little bit more. Seems kind of like a best practice. So you've got the Zylo Agile delivery method.
Also, the conversations just from the engineering over the last week have been really interesting. I think they're very much more bought into this idea as well. And so while it's primarily a shift in how we interact with product and how they think of projects, the team has been much more excited and much more collaborative, I think, as they've started to kind of take ownership of their delivery of the project.
That's what you want to see, ownership. When we think about these small teams and PagerDuty, so operational issues, how do you distribute those kind of responsibilities among the teams?
Right now, we've been pretty lucky. So our tool is really a business tool that is used during business hours. So one of the benefits of not being in a marketing software company is you don't have consumers using your tool at all hours of the day. So really that peak usage where there might be an issue is really going to happen during our work hours. And right now the PagerDuty type aspect is really split across the same team that has those deployer access. It hasn't been really defined. We haven't really needed to define it. We've built our systems pretty resilient in the fact that one part goes down, it does not cause an emergency. And so knock on wood, haven't had a lot of those instances where we've been calling people and waking them up in the middle of the night or anything.
Gotcha. So the small subset of engineers that have deploy production access, they rotate the pager among them, and it's not been a heavy load as a result.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I might be speaking for Will Larson, but I think you were reading Elegant Puzzle also. Is that where you came up with that?
Started. I haven't got too far, but yeah.
My read is he's got a infrastructure lens, and if you're maintaining the infrastructure for a huge organization or, financial transactions where you have a lot of variety and, a lot of latency problems or, constraints, that pager is more onerous. And if you really are going to have lots of pager, a lot of incidents, 6 to 8 does seem like a reasonable load to not drive all your engineers crazy.
Yeah, definitely. I think minimizing the amount of time someone has to dedicate to support work is important, and especially that emergency type support work can be pretty stressful and interrupting. And so I would definitely agree on that bigger kind of wider net, especially as we grow, to make sure that those responsibilities don't fall on just a few engineers.
So we talked before we started recording about you going from maybe 20-ish to 30-ish engineers over the next year. How are you thinking about how that team structure will need to change as you grow by 50%?
I think as this new structure should allow us to be a little bit more flexible and not need kind of that rigid pyramid type architecture. Really, I think these pods can hopefully be pretty self-sustaining as long as we've got kind of that right mix of experience. So as we think of those headcount planning steps over the next 12 months, it's really kind of that mix of associate or entry-level candidates, mid-level candidates that have done software engineering for a few years, and then a few senior-level experienced engineers that can really help drive this process and really kind of own it, maybe across teams.
So is a pod that team of two or three? Is that a pod?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so you think you'll be able to just add pods? And did I hear that the ideal mix for one of those pods is one senior, one mid-level, and one associate? Possibly one associate.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Interesting. I've had a few conversations about what's the ideal seniority mix of a team, and I keep what do you find to be the ideal mix if you're going to look across your org, 50% senior, 10% associate.
Well, we have an interesting mix. So I did the math the other day. Half of my team has never written software professionally.
Wow.
But it's probably the most fun team I've been on in a long time. And so I think we're definitely skewed younger than probably the average. But I think in that you find a lot more eagerness and a willingness to really do whatever it takes. And that's probably the exciting part.
Yeah, I've heard one third is the thing that gets thrown out the most. Like one third in their first 2 years, one third senior, and one third in between. And you're 50% in their first 2 years. Is that what I just heard?
Yeah.
I would have. I think Pass West would have said if you have a 50% junior level team, you probably need bigger teams. But it sounds like you're being successful with smaller teams. What do you think? What do you attribute that to?
I think it's the right mix of the candidates that have the experience, those ones that are willing to teach. You can find a lot of good engineers that are really smart that don't want to help other people. They just want to do their own thing.
Right.
And so I think it's that good mix of the ones that want to be the teachers and the ones that on the other side want to learn from those people and just don't want to figure them out themselves. Really that collaboration aspect.
So I can't imagine that's by accident that you've managed to hire senior people that are excited to mentor and good at it. Could you talk us through your hiring process and how you kind of select for that whenever you're growing your team?
So for our hiring process, what we do is we really try to involve a lot of people from our team with the candidates, really to provide a lot of opinions and have everyone kind of take their unique angle with that candidate. So what we'll do, by the time they've done a coding style test and come on site, they'll meet with really four blocks of people. They'll meet with myself, again, just kind of for that direct hiring relationship. They'll meet with someone from product so they can see how they'll interact with the product team. They'll meet with a group of engineers to talk really culture fit style questions, personality questions, team fit, and then another team of engineers will talk more technical through their code assessment and really try to ask them questions kind of leading up to how they think about problems and how they solve them. We aren't big on coding styles, but really more interested in kind of that architect mind and how they think about a problem they would tackle.
That makes sense. Yeah, the problem solving pieces is maybe the most important. One thing I didn't hear you say there was anything about mentorship or coaching or collaboration, at least explicitly. Am I right that you're getting most of that implicitly by just getting folks in those conversations?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just really trying to ask really good questions about their personality, how they've worked with coworkers in the past. But really, I don't think any times we're asking too direct of our candidates, really just trying to maybe get at that answer, yeah, a little more implicitly.
Makes sense. So you've hired 20-ish engineers. How has your process evolved? You raised a $9 million Series A a little bit while back. How has that process evolved as you've kind of the needs to scale more quickly have hit you?
Yeah, I think really what we did is we tried to, in the beginning, to have kind of a coding assessment that was one size fits all. I think as we got into hiring up a little bit faster, realized that wasn't the best way to do it. And so really branched off into kind of three different directions. One was focusing on those new hire type candidates, asking just much more of a theoretical style challenge, asking them to solve a problem, walk us through some pseudocode, a database diagram, really not concerned how they solved actual problems, but just really trying to understand what they would do in that situation in their language of their choice. The second area would be really trying to focus in on showing a candidate what type of work they're going to be doing here. So we've taken a project, sliced it out of our API, and really made it half complete and asked them to kind of complete it and maybe improve on a few areas. And so that gives them a good understanding of the types of languages and frameworks that we're using in our API. And so they can get a good sense of, you know, what am I getting into? So it's really not that different than maybe a day-to-day around here for some of the engineers.
And is this a take-home style assessment where they, go off on their own and complete it and then send it back your way?
Yes, exactly.
And I heard you said there was three different ways. I heard the entry and then the half of an API project. Is there a third?
That third one is really focused more on the front-end engineers, and so that gives them a little bit more flexibility to maybe show their design skills a little bit, and so asking them to connect to any public API and really visualize some data for us. And that one's a pretty open-ended one. We don't use that a ton just because can require a little bit more work than the project that's already started. And we're really trying to be fair with the time. We're trying not to ask for very much time. We also put in our code challenge, you know, the more is not better. So if you spend double the amount of time, that probably sends more red flags than it does good ones to us. And so we really try to call that out quite often to say, minimize your amount of time. We understand what we're asking here and really not trying to take advantage of the candidate.
And when it comes on the back end of that, so they've gone out and did this project. Sounds like with the entry level, there's a lot of talking about the choices made. With the other two levels, is this a maybe my question is, how often do you find that a candidate's not a fit as a result of that project versus how often is this something that you use to kind of place them or find their strengths and weaknesses?
It's pretty rare that we would find someone that we would exclude in this process, in that technical process. We have had some people that refused to do it, which that was a clear indicator that we couldn't move forward. But for the most time, I think it's more that placement, really trying to understand where they are. Like if they maybe were light on experience, applied for a senior spot, but then they showed really promising skills in the code challenge, we may say, yeah, they might qualify or they might be closer than we thought and someone we want to continue to bring on site and vet out, but really more of that placement.
So you've been running these kind of take-home assessments for a while now. If you could go back in time and give, maybe two or three years ago, Ryan, advice, like something you've learned, what do you think you would tell your past self?
I think it would have been to do the theoretical work earlier. I think at first, you know, our requirements were that be in Node because that's our primary language. It needed to be in React as well. I think we probably potentially lost out on some candidates there just from that requirement that we had. And so really trying to be more flexible. I think having a web software background is important, but really being a little bit more flexible in the beginning days would have probably served us a little bit better.
So there might have been some candidates that could have done well in Ruby or Python, and they weren't comfortable with Node, so they kind of self-selected out.
Yeah, I think so.
That makes sense. So you've hired some stack switchers. How do you feel about their onboarding curve versus folks that came in with a native stack? Is it a month longer, 3 months longer, 9 months longer?
I think for us, I would lean towards the smaller side. I think it's a month longer. I don't think it takes that much to really shift the type of code you're writing. I think it's more of just getting familiar with how it executes and really understanding our system more than anything. And so I don't think that switching languages is really a big part of that. I think there's a little bit, but I wouldn't probably put it too much different than someone just coming over that's new to the team.
Yeah, month is not that much longer. It can take way more than that to find the next good candidate. So that's a great trade-off. Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help teams hit ambitious hiring goals. Usually, that means finding talent that might go overlooked. For a lot of organizations, that means people who apply from job boards. We analyzed 3,000 software engineering job board applications. From that, we found that 87% of our customers' top performing applicants actually came from job boards. These top applicants from job boards outperform candidates that are sourced by recruiters and internal recruiters by over 30%. And a lot of companies, these people get completely overlooked, but not with Woven. At Woven, we've built a process for identifying these top-tier job board applicants without having to sort through the hundreds of wrong applications. 87% of the top performing were from job boards, but almost all of the worst performing were also from job boards. If you want to see how we've helped companies across the country make better use of their job boards, go to woventeams.com/demo. Again, if you want to learn how we help engineering leaders hire great engineers from job boards without headhunter fees, that's woventeams.com/demo. So Ryan, now it is time for the rapid fire round. So I'm going to make a short statement, and you're going to give me your answer and try to be 60 seconds or less. Are you ready?
Okay, let's go.
Let's do it. What does a 6-star culture fit look like at Xylo? So even better than 5 stars.
I think for us to, to say a 6-star fit, it's really that personality. I think working at a startup is really tough on certain days, and really having that person that you want to go to battle with and that can take a bad day and come back from it and it not let it sit and sulk in their mind, and really someone that's just got that good attitude to keep, keep plugging away, because it's a tough process.
What advice do you have for an engineer that's looking to get hired on one of your teams?
I think it's back to that culture. I mean, I think we are willing to, as I said earlier, with the 50% team of new hires, I think we're really willing to take a chance on about anyone. And it's really that attitude that you come up with and really that attitude you show in the interview process. I think one thing that is definitely kind of missed in our area is that kind of feedback loop after the interview. You see that in a lot of other roles. You don't see that in engineering. I think that goes a long way when a candidate reaches back out to say, hey, thanks for taking the time. Because it's a big time involvement for us to interview a candidate.
It can never hurt to reach back out. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made in an interview on either side of the table?
So I was at Purdue right after I graduated, and I was asked, what's my ideal kind of environment? And I described much more of a startup environment, where you long hours, you work hard, but maybe you get a Friday off. That's not how they operate at a big university. And so that was probably the funniest one, because she actually called me out on it and I kind of had to try to backtrack, but I was destined not to probably work at a big university at that point. So that was probably one of the funnier ones.
Yeah. You've just described very much not here.
Yes.
Could you walk me through the interview you've had that left the biggest positive impression of a candidate?
Yeah, I'm going to cheat and just say, because it was the last one, so it's probably the most fresh, but it was also a really good one, because the most of the team said, this is one of the better interviews we've ever had. And I think it was just that person's humbleness about their accomplishments. They were really down to earth. I think you can meet a lot of smart people when you're talking to these engineering candidates, but it's just really those people that are humble about it and don't really oversell. They don't need to oversell what they've done, but they're really, they talk about their teams, they talk about their coworkers. Really, you can just kind of tell from what they talk about, what they care most about.
My guest today has been Ryan Carroll. Ryan, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Ryan for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, top teams change part of their agile process. Top teams make the process their own. They just don't take it off the shelf. The Basecamp team recently released a book called Shape Up. One of the core concepts there that Ryan has adopted at Xylo is time boxing. They time box their projects across 6 weeks. It's a 6 week scope of work, and then 2 weeks to shape and reset. That's enough time to build something, but not enough time for scope to get really too far out of hand, too far out of our heads. They're also building small teams with lots of focus on delivery. That changes the relationship with product owners, because we have small teams of two developers. Leads to more shaping of work and more focus on big picture framing. Number two, big funding rounds can necessitate big team changes. When we need to double or triple, we have to think about scalability of our teams. It's also much easier to hire junior and mid-level engineers, so creating a team structure that supports those junior and mid-level engineers makes us more scalable. Smaller team pods support that, when we can mix a senior engineer with a mid-level engineer and an early career engineer. When we need to scale, we can just add more pods. Number three, big team changes necessitate hiring process changes. So we raised money, we changed our team, and now we need to change our hiring process. Hiring is a team sport. Ryan introduces candidates to as many teams as possible to foster a culture of collaboration and get more perspective. There's less focus on coding style and more focus on architecture and problem solving. Thanks again to Ryan for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.